This is the Community Forum, a public affairs presentation of the Montrose Broadcasting Corporation. Welcome to the program. It is good to have you along. As we talk today about Diabetes Awareness Month, Dr. Michael Adler of Evangelical Hospital's Endocrinology Department is joining us for a discussion of diabetes and some of the latest developments, how far we've come, and some ways to determine if there is a problem in your life or that of a loved one. Thanks for joining us on the program, Dr. Adler. Let's begin with the definition of diabetes and a little differentiation between the type 1 and type 2 forms of this illness.
So diabetes is a group of disorders that are all categorized as having elevated blood sugar. In type 1 diabetes, patients have typically an autoimmune process where the body actually destroys something called beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And they have typically, not long after the disease onset, no production of insulin. And type 2 diabetes, it's really a different group of disorders where there's not enough insulin, but it's highly variable, where some people make some insulin, some people make a lot of insulin, but it's just not enough for their needs. And the genetics probably are stronger with type 2 diabetes, so people are more likely to have a family history of diabetes.
And with type 1, I mean, a lot of times we hear about kids. Is it always starting in childhood, or does that sometimes an autoimmune thing that takes over later in life?
So, I mean, that's a great question, because not that many years ago when I was in training, we were taught it almost invariably starts early in life, almost never past the age of 40. And what we've learned is, although it's very common to happen at an early age, typically in children, you actually will see a fair number of people develop diabetes type 1 at a later age, and we're finding people developing it in their 40s and 50s. So age alone isn't the criteria. The difference is when people develop it typically after their teens or after puberty, the onset can be much slower, and sometimes type 1 and type 2 diabetes can be confused. And the people who have this late onset diabetes typically are leaner, and that's one thing, and frequently but not always don't have a family history of diabetes, especially type 1.
And for type 2 then, would you say is it always avoidable or very often avoidable? It seems like there are lifestyle things. If you've done them your whole life, you're going to have a lesser chance of getting diabetes?
Well, I think the latter of what you said is correct. I think that if you adhere to a healthy lifestyle, keep your weight down as best you can, stay active, watch your diet, if your genetics are very strong, you're still going to develop diabetes, but you can put it off to a much later age. And there are probably a group of people who will develop it no matter what, but there are some people who probably can prevent it during their lifetime by adhering to a healthy lifestyle. So it's, again, a combination of environment and genetics, but certainly our environment and what we do for ourselves can make a huge difference.
How does the rate of diabetes in the rest of the world compare to the U.S.? I'm always kind of amazed by our diet, and I would think that would impact it, or maybe it doesn't, but any idea on the comparison there?
So, I mean, diabetes is growing worldwide, and as countries become more industrialized, they change from their native diets, people become more sedentary, prevalence of diabetes tends to increase fairly dramatically. So, I mean, we're seeing where parts of the world where diabetes used to be rare to becoming more common. So really, the changes in lifestyle make a huge difference in how frequently we're seeing diabetes in some of these developing countries. Certainly, we've seen it for decades in the United States. And the other thing that makes a big difference is an aging population. The longer people live, typically there's some deficiency in insulin that also contributes to diabetes. And some people have old age diabetes, is a way of saying it, just severe insulin deficiency, just because they've lived a long time.
Yeah, that reminds me of my grandmother who died like 30 years ago, but when she was much older, she had diabetes, but she wasn't really on insulin or anything. Is that probably an example of the older, just old age, that you can kind of manage it with diet and so forth?
Well, I think it's, again, highly variable. I think for many people, they can manage it with medications. You know, just like your grandmother, I had a grandmother who developed diabetes somewhat later in life. She was a senior citizen. And I remember at the time, and I was just starting my medical training, her doctor kind of said, well, you know, her diabetes isn't that serious. It's late in life. Unfortunately, from her not having well-controlled diabetes, she suffered diabetic complications, nerve damage, which eventually led to her falling in the end of life years earlier than it should have been. So, you know, I think that there are some people at an older age who will get away with diet, exercise, a pill. She needed insulin later in life. So, again, I think it depends how long you're going to live. And, again, there are many different factors. One of the biggest problems with diabetes is people may go for years before they get detected if they're not getting yearly or biannual blood tests with their primary care provider.
And that raises the question to me is how far have we come? I mean, in the last 10 years, 20, 30 years, have the ways of spotting and treating this improved greatly? Are we exponentially increasing, or is it slow and steady?
So I think, you know, I mean, I graduated medical school roughly 30 years ago. And I think back then, very few people were screened unless they were symptomatic. I think today, more and more people are getting routine blood tests. I think the delay in diagnosis is not as long as it used to be, where people usually are getting diagnosed now in the first few years rather than a decade out. The problem is there's still a group of people who never see healthcare providers and may get much later diagnosis for that reason, that no one's testing them. And that's a group of people that is very hard to reach. For the other people, I think we are doing a better job with screening and detecting earlier.
What should we look for in ourselves or others to see that there could be a problem developing?
So one of the problems is in people with diabetes, this has been called the silent killer, because for many people who have just mild blood sugar elevation, they may have absolutely no symptoms. In people who have more significant high blood sugar, you know, it's a little easier to diagnose. People start noticing, gee, I'm urinating more, I'm drinking more, I'm eating more, but I'm losing weight, my vision may be a little blurry. Those are classic symptoms of uncontrolled diabetes. But fortunately or unfortunately, many people don't have those symptoms. So, again, I think screening is the key, but certainly anybody who has family history, has a friend, anyone, they notice a lot of those symptoms, should recommend that they get checked for diabetes, get their blood sugar checked.
And I've known people that said they come home from the doctor for their regular appointment. They say, they told me I'm pre-diabetic. Kind of define that. Is that something you can find out and step back and maybe avoid diabetes, or is that just a step in the process?
So pre-diabetes is somewhere between normal blood sugar and diabetes, and it kind of makes sense that if we say a fasting blood sugar, for example, under 100 is normal and 126 is diabetes, 100 to 125 on that fasting blood sugar be pre-diabetes. And that concept really was pushed about 1997. The American Diabetes Association released some guidelines, which have been updated a little bit over the years, but trying to find people with pre-diabetes, with the thought being that that is a high-risk group of people, and these are people, one, who we can screen more regularly, but also recommend things like lifestyle intervention, and in a certain subset of people, perhaps medications to delay the onset of diabetes. And, you know, again, we have a lot of new medications coming out. I think, you know, ideally we would prevent many people from developing diabetes. I think the concept of pre-diabetes is great. One of the problems that we face is the FDA, which is the body that regulates drugs, has not recognized pre-diabetes as a disease state, and therefore no pharmaceutical company can really study a drug for prevention of diabetes at this time and get it approved for that indication.
Aside from cancer, I always feel like diabetes is the scariest thing to me. Has it come to the point where maybe I shouldn't be as scared because if I find out and manage it, it's very manageable? Or is it so variable that, you know, I can... I could end up with a terrible case or a mild case. Is that a thing?
Well, I mean, so certainly part of the problem with diabetes is the high blood sugar itself can lead to complications like kidney problems, even dialysis, nerve damage, which can lead to loss of limbs, loss of eyesight. But in addition, diabetes is associated with things like heart disease, and liver disease is becoming an increasingly important problem in patients with diabetes, especially obesity and insulin resistance. And, you know, we can do things at the moment to really control diabetes. Our new drugs are much better than they were 30 years ago at helping people get control of their weight and their blood sugar if they can tolerate them. We are much better at lowering heart disease risk by lowering cholesterol and blood pressure, getting people to get screened for problems early, like eye disease, where if you catch it early, you can prevent it from getting worse, and people at high risk for amputation to check their feet regularly. So there's a lot of things we can do for our patients to lower risk. So I think things are getting better, but again, we still have a battle that's ongoing, and we need more treatments to help with things, especially fatty liver disease, which we're finding is one of the leading causes of end-stage liver disease or cirrhosis now, increasing much more common than alcohol and hepatitis C, and it's going to be a big problem over the coming decades.
Prevention, aside from the medicines we can take, what can we do now before a diagnosis to avoid that happening?
Sure. So certainly keeping a healthy weight helps. Easier said than done. Certainly exercising regularly seems to help. Eating a healthier diet, diets that are a bit lower in carbohydrate may help. People are looking into time-restricted eating may help. And again, I think part of the problem with diets is everybody's different. So what works for me may not work for you, so we have to really individualize these things. But I think, you know, lifestyle can only go so far, and I think that, you know, pharmacology and medications may be part of the future there.
Is there a percentage of the country that you would say suffers at least with some level of diabetes?
So I think that when we look at the population, it's well over 10% of the adult population has diabetes. Typically, type 1 diabetes affects about 1% of the population. And when you start getting into the older age groups, senior citizens, you know, I've heard numbers as high as a quarter of people having diabetes. So the numbers are tremendous and unfortunately are going to get worse with an aging population.
And I'm assuming the baby boomers reaching senior age was would knock the numbers up because of the sheer masses of people that are in that generation.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the epidemic is really growing. And one of the biggest problems we're facing is there are not enough healthcare providers with expertise in diabetes to really take care of all these people. So that's going to become another problem we're going to face. And people are looking into ways to reach out into communities to help. They're looking for innovative strategies, looking at things that we don't see a lot now, like community health workers to go out and help educate people on diet and activity and taking their medications. And I think there's a lot of things we can do. Even insurance companies can do more in helping people get their medications and afford them.
And when it comes to curing or at least managing, type 1 versus type 2, have we seen developments for type 1, or is it pretty much the same once you've got it, how you're handling it?
There's been a major revolution over the past few decades in managing type 1 diabetes. You know, I think years ago, everybody was hopeful that the big thing was going to be a cure. We were going to give people a new pancreas and their diabetes would be cured. I think we've come to realize that that is not so simple. There are a lot of issues involved. There's not enough pancreases to transplant. There are problems with the drugs involved with that. And really what's come to, I think, help many people is technology, where we're developing these wonderful new glucose sensors that people can be aware of where their blood sugars are, alarm them if they're too high or too low. In addition, I think that the newer pump technologies are amazing. That pumps years ago used to just be another way to give insulin. So if somebody said, I don't want to give myself four shots a day, they'd go on a pump. But the new pumps actually work with the sensors, and they have artificial intelligence where they can actually shut a pump off if someone's blood sugar is going low, give them additional insulin if their sugars are high, and really help assist. It's almost like a co-pilot in taking care of someone's diabetes. And some of the next generations of pumps, which are starting to come out, are actually beginning to help people with taking the proper amount of insulin with their meals. So I think that's another very exciting thing. So, you know, where type 1 diabetes used to be tremendously difficult because every minute of your life you'd have to think about, what am I eating? What's my activity? Am I under stress? All of those things can affect someone's blood sugar. You know, is my sugar going low too quickly and I'm not sensing it, because many people couldn't. Now these new pumps that are intelligent, or smart pumps, as many people have called them, are really starting to become the standard of care. Not everybody wants one, but for many people, this is really, I think, becoming something that can improve outcomes, help people really stay healthier and live longer, and hopefully prevent diabetic complications by keeping people very well controlled with their diabetes.
We want to thank the doctor for joining us today, but we're going to continue with another quick interview with Stephanie Steller. She's an RN, a diabetes educator with the Department of Endocrinology at Evangelical. We're going to hear what her part is in dealing with someone who has been diagnosed. Can you tell us first, what is a patient educator and how do you work in that role with patients?
I work with them with balanced meals, encouraging physical activity, checking their blood sugar, giving them tools of how to check their blood sugar with insulin meters, insulin pens, pumps, continuous glucose monitors. So just the tools to help them with everyday life living with diabetes. So everybody's diabetes is different. So whether you have type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes, pre-diabetes, everybody is very individualized. So it's very unique to the patient, and it's individualized based off of where they stand with their stage of their diabetes.
I have a couple friends who had a child diagnosed with type 1 pretty young. And do you work directly with the kids, or do you do more with the parents in those cases?
I was the pediatric diabetes educator for 7 years, and myself including, I have type 1 and I was diagnosed at the age of 11. So I kind of sympathize and empathize with those parents and with those children, you know, adolescents and, you know, the whole, I've worked from anywhere from 18 months of diagnosis up to, you know, some patients come to me at 79 years old. I've had that huge spectrum, which I think is awesome because it teaches me as well. You know, everybody is very unique, like I said.
In the case of, you know, whether it's a child or an adult, is your job kind of satisfying in that you can give them some hope? How do you kind of provide them the hope that this is manageable?
Whenever they come into my office, I do have patients who are like, I was nervous to come see you. And I'm like, listen, this is a safe place. You're going to come in. We're going to just talk about, what do you want from me? What is your dire need? Some patients just come and they vent to me. You know, I can't manage this. I can't do that. So I say, what is your biggest problem? And we focus on one thing at a time. And once they leave the appointment, they're like, I gained so much knowledge from you of these little small steps every single day is going to help me in the long term. And that's what we're trying to avoid, is long-term complications.
Do you meet with somebody when diagnosed, or is it sort of an ongoing process until they're until they feel comfortable? Or
so I meet them if they are newly diagnosed at the hospital. I cover the hospital at Evangelical, and whenever they are newly diagnosed, I will go over to the hospital and I will meet with them, provide them the tools that they need for discharge, and then meet with them afterwards and close follow-up. But then also, if they are established with diabetes, then I meet with them if they're troubleshooting, if their A1C, their hemoglobin A1C is high, or if they are having trouble with their pumps or their sensors, or they just need a little bit more knowledge because sometimes they don't have any education from their primary care doctor. So then I'll meet with them and go over, this is the basics. Let's go back to the basics.
Is your job as patient educator a newer approach?
I know that for myself, I've been an educator for 10 years now. We need that support from a diabetes educator who specializes in that to give that knowledge because our physicians, our physician assistants, our nurse practitioners, they do not have the time to educate. So, you know, just having that separate time frame that we can sit down with the patient and go over everything.
How successful do you find it is to reach out to these people and give them the advice they need?
I do have patients who come in here and they just sit in my office and then they don't really talk much. And then once I make them comfortable in the atmosphere that they're in, then they leave and they're like, I didn't know that. I've been, you know, diagnosed with diabetes for 17 years and I didn't know to do this or to eat that or, you know, all the little tricks and tips that I give them based off of what they're telling me. You know, they leave here and they're like, thank you so much. Like, I didn't want to come. I didn't want to pay to come see you, but it was really helpful at the end of the visit. So I do hear that more times than not.
And that concludes today's WPGM Community Forum with Dr. Michael Adler of Evangelical Community Hospital's Endocrinology Department. We want to thank you, Dr. Michael Adler, and we want to thank you, Stephanie Steller, for being with us. And we want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. This has been a presentation of the Montrose Broadcasting Corporation. The views expressed on the community forum by our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the moderator, staff, or management of this station.